The Ear, Evangelical and Reformed, Christian Podcast. Welcome to The Ear, the Evangelical and Reformed, a Christian podcast that urges you to think deeper and draws you closer to God through faith. Through powerful sermons, teaching segments, and discussions, The Ear hopes to give you a different perspective on secular topics from a Christian worldview. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Please welcome your host, Brandon Queen.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I'm back with another episode of Prayer. And today's topic or discussion will be prayer and philosophy. And with me, I got my friend since diaper days, Britton Frost, with us. And he is going to touch up on the philosophy side while I try to answer some of the prayer stuff side. So a little bit about Britton. Britton is weird.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
They'll learn that on their own, I'm sure.
He's weird. He has a beard, and I'm jealous.
Sometimes.
And he has wavy locks of hair. But anyway, Britton has a master's in philosophy from the University of Buckingham, United Kingdom. I guess that's how you would say that.
Of course.
And then he has a bachelor's in philosophy from the University of New Orleans. So, yeah, we could say he knows the topic of philosophy. Britton and I go way back to, like I said, diaper days. We attended church together, and then we also did scouting together for a while, and I finished, and he didn't.
That's right.
Quitter.
I went off to study philosophy because I'm one of those people, right?
Yeah, okay. All right, so... also, Britton has a bunch of this dude's, like I said, he's random. He's randomly weird. He's got, I think you got is the motocross job you were talking about earlier?
Motorsports in general, mainly road racing cars and motorcycles and go-karts. Yeah. Go-karts. Work at a motorsport facility and travel a bit, officiating motorsport events. Yeah.
Okay. And then he does the, he sometimes gets on film sets a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Work in film. Yeah, musician playing a couple of rock bands, drummer.
And then you just got a new position at the Baton Rouge Community College. Tell us about that.
I actually haven't started it yet, but I will be starting in the fall of this year at the very latest as an adjunct instructor in philosophy. Teaching probably logic, biomedical ethics, maybe introduction to philosophy, whatever they need me to do. The idea behind philosophy in a community college, you don't hear of that very often, right?
Right.
But that's something that's being phased in, and I think it's a really good thing. Because for humanities students, most students in general, they ask, why do I have to take math if it's not directly related to my degree, right?
Math sucks.
Yeah, if you don't have a natural knack for math, you've asked that question at some point, right? So what they're doing, they're finding that that's actually a legitimate question that people ask from early age all the way through college. Why am I taking math when I'm not going to need it? Because that's true. So what they're doing is they're replacing algebra on the college level for humanities students with logic. And so logic is a very analytical, very left-brained discipline, just like algebra and the rest of mathematics, but it's more widely applicable to a wider range of applications. I mean, it's you learn the rules of good argumentation, you learn the errors of good reasoning, and you learn how to dissect an argument based on its logical structure. And that can be very useful in conversation, in helping, if you're mediating a conversation, to help the two sides debating understand each other rather than get at each other's throats, So it has a lot of applications in the business realm, and it's just an overall very useful skill, logic, and learning how to reason well.
Yeah, logic is a form of math, isn't it?
It can be, yeah. It has its symbolic form, where basically a logical proof that you try to solve is just like, almost just like an algebraic equation. So it can be very difficult, you know, it's very analytical. And I would say that it's more or less the same thing. Bertrand Russell, a philosopher of the early 20th century, spent his whole career trying to find the logical foundations of mathematics. He thought that mathematics had the basic rules of logic underlying them. And he, you know, did a lot of work, wrote thousands and thousands of pages on that topic. At the end of the day, I don't think he was 100% successful with that. But the general idea stands that logic and math are very similar. But logic also includes, say, studying, you know, it's not just doing equations like math is. You can, like I do on my little Philosopher Friday show on Snapchat that I post on Instagram and YouTube as well, or I have been lately. Sometimes I'll go over a logical fallacy, a basic error in reasoning, right? Such as ad hominem, okay? Argumentum ad hominem, that's the Latin word for it. It means appeal to offense. Or so an ad hominem argument is an argument that you make on the basis of offending someone or insulting someone, calling them names instead of actually focusing on the relevant argument, you know?
Ad hominem.
Yeah. Ad populum is appeal to the masses. You believe something because the majority of people believe it. That's not going to determine what's true necessarily, right?
Makes sense.
So you want to keep the focus on the content of the argument rather than maybe how it's expressed or what tools of rhetoric are used to win the argument. It's about truth rather than winning, you know?
Nice. Yeah. All right. So, oh, that's a cool looking dog. Anywho.
Yeah. We're up on the second floor of my parents' house looking down onto the street.
downtown Thibodeau.
Yeah. People walking their dogs and whatnot. Could be distracting. Do you need to close
the
blinds?
No, we're good. We're good. All right. So we're going to go ahead and dive into this discussion of philosophy and prayer, or prayer and philosophy, whatever.
Yeah. The philosophy of prayer, perhaps?
I like that.
Okay.
We'll call it that. All right. So the first question is, well, Britton, what is philosophy?
Philosophy, that is a philosophical topic unto itself. So I'm not going to give you a 100% clear answer about that, just to warn you, nor will I about any of these things, because as a philosopher type, I'm not really always super confident in having a straightforward opinion about things. I just want to figure out between the two of us what's the most reasonable thing to believe in that regard, you know? So philosophy, I can start with Bertrand Russell, who I mentioned earlier. He had an interesting take on this. He contrasted science and religion to try to figure out what philosophy is, because philosophy seems to have elements of both of those things in it. So on one hand, you have science that deals with the empirical world. It's a method of inquiry used to test empirical matter, gather data about it, and formulate predictions about future events in the natural empirical realm.
Okay.
And then on the other hand, you have religion, which he was an atheist, by the way, but so I guess he saw religion as a more intuition-based, community-based activity. You share faith with other people, faith in something, and he's speaking about religion in very general terms. You share a faith in something collectively, and it should guide your actions, guide your moral actions in some way. So philosophy is kind of in that no man's land between science and religion. Philosophy does depend on evidence, but not of the empirical matter-based sort, right? It depends on logical, analytical evidence. And then on the other hand, it's kind of like religion in that it is concerned with questions such as morality and ethics and how should you act and how should you behave. But it's not as pragmatic a discipline as, say, religion is. But it's also different from religion and science. It's different from science because it's not confined to material reality and empirical reality. And it's not just, you know, it considers different types of evidence. And it also is similar or is also different from religion because it focuses on things like morality from a different angle. You know,
okay,
and maybe we'll leave it there and discuss that a little more.
Gotcha.
Throughout the podcast.
All right. So, from a philosophical standpoint,
sure.
Does prayer have a point?
So there hasn't been too much written in academic philosophy on prayer itself. There's a lot written on philosophy of religion in general, but I was actually listening to a lecture the other night by Dr. David Gottlieb. I think he's a PhD in theology, but he's a rabbi. He's a Jewish rabbi, okay. And he said that the purpose of prayer is to ask for something. Now there are certain formalities that you have to include in that, right? Such as praising God and showing gratitude. Those are formalities that you include when you pray. But at the end of the day, you're asking for something, whether it's for something more material or something more spiritual, like God provide me strength to get through this situation in my life, whatever it is. So I thought, like, as a starting point, that was a pretty good definition of prayer. It's an outgoing, you know, you're projecting something beyond yourself and asking for something in return. But at the end of the day, God's will is God's will, okay. Right? So you can't just ask for a Ferrari and expect that to be granted because you showed gratitude and showed praise and went through all of the formalities in asking for that thing. If you deserve it at the end of the day, and if it's God's will, then it'll be granted to you. But that's probably because you took it upon yourself to work hard to earn enough money to buy a Ferrari.
I will never own a Ferrari.
That's okay. You don't want to look like a snob. I know a lot of Ferrari owners at the racetrack.
Huh. They won't go racing those cars around.
No. All right. They're nice to drive, though. I'm not going to lie. Huh. No, don't. Look, that's one of those things. It's like having a yacht. You know, Ferrari's like having a yacht. You don't want to go through the struggle of buying one of those things yourself and having to own it. Just have friends who have nice toys, you know, so you can enjoy them, and it's all fun and no responsibility on your part.
See, I don't have
it's like having a dog too, you know.
But I don't have any friends that have Ferraris. Like,
no, I'll introduce you to some. They won't be your real friends. You can, you know,
acquaintances.
The acquaintances, right?
Got it. All right. So, why does United Prayer exert a stronger influence upon a soul than when one prays alone? Basically, a group of people praying together versus a person praying by himself.
Sure. That's interesting. Maybe, can we come back to that one?
We can.
So let's, what do you think of the rabbi's definition of prayer?
Yeah. All right. I'm glad you asked me that one. So looking at it, I mean, I can't go against a Jewish rabbi.
Oh, sure you can. It's not the same denomination. You're already at war with him by virtue of your, you know, your place.
But I still love him.
Of course.
Now, let me see.
Jews are smart and funny people.
Yeah, they are. I know one
generally
of them.
Like them.
See, the purpose of prayer is asking for something.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree with that to an extent.
Okay.
And you kind of hit home when you said we can either pray for material things or spiritual things or the outcome of certain things.
Sure.
But prayer can also be just praising God, not asking for anything.
Oh, I see.
See,
the rabbi said that that was not prayer. That because his, by his definition,
okay, yeah,
by his definition, the purpose of prayer is to ask for something. That although those, you know, morning blessings and everything are nice before you go to bed, that's not actually prayer, he would say.
Now,
you may have a more general definition of prayer. I'm not saying his definition is correct, you know, or more correct than the Christian definition. Mm-hmm. But in general, would you say that the Christian definition of prayer is more general than the rabbis? It does include blessings and just showing praise and gratitude.
I would say on a broader perspective, we agree in the same thing.
Okay.
But what I was getting at was he's saying it's asking for something, but if you look through the book of Psalms, that whole book, all 66 books, are prayers.
Right.
You know, and some of them are strictly praises to God, or, you know, letting God know he's good for X, Y, Z.
Sure.
So.
I see.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, that's interesting. I think a lot of Jewish people, not to say that Christians aren't the same, but a lot of Jewish people, because if they're Orthodox Jews,
yeah,
they're unreformed and they're very strict in how they define things. And they may tend to reduce definitions down to one variable, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So he may be more comfortable with the idea of categorizing prayer as a... in the way that he defined it, rather than broadening it out to include a bunch of other things that he acknowledges as important, obviously praising God, showing gratitude, etc., going through the, but he, at the end of the day, he calls those formalities. So I don't know, maybe this is going off on a tangent and we don't have to talk about it, but I'm wondering if on the extreme end, if Jews believe in some kind of predestined reality to an extent that Christians don't.
That's interesting.
Because, you know, his definition of prayer says something like, at the end of the day, prayer doesn't matter because God's will is God's will. And what will happen, and you still have to deal with it accordingly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, with him being Jewish and knowing his heritage and his history, it's kind of... Well, I think it'd be kind of funny he'd say it like that. You know, prayer is only asking for something. I mean,
yeah, it did seem a little strict to me. Like when I heard that, you know,
yeah.
I thought that maybe he'd have a more general definition, but
I get his concept on why he's stating it like that.
Sure,
but I mean, it's not just asking for something,
right?
You know, I mean, when you read Psalm 23, you know, yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow of death, I will fear no evil. You know, you would say, oh, that's just a poetic poem. It could be a prayer, too.
Sure.
And most of the Psalms are prayers and songs. So, I don't know. I can't wrap my head around that one. That one's kind of weird.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I mean, it's a good answer. It's just, if he's only going to categorize prayer as a way of asking for things, because when you look at prayer in a general sense, like you and I are sitting here talking to each other, looking at each other.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And God is... this omnipresent being. So when we pray, that is our connection with the human and the holy.
I see.
Versus you and I, when we talk to each other, we're getting that physical.
Is it meant to be the most direct connection?
Yes.
That you make communicative connection with God?
Yes.
Okay, I see.
That's why I'm kind of strange that the rabbi would state it as just asking for something.
Right.
You know?
Well, maybe... maybe on the other hand, he believes, and you know, I didn't get into this because the lecture that I listened to was specifically about the definition of prayer and his view. Maybe the Jews have a broader definition of connection with God,
mm-hmm.
end quote, if that makes sense. Like they feel more directly connected to God in their everyday life when they're doing things other than praying, you know, like, cause he did mention that, basically everything that you do and say and think to a certain degree, must be offered up to God. It must in some way serve God.
I agree.
Right. So you would agree with that. Yeah. Right. So maybe that's a point on which you'd converge. And then when you decide to pray, that is more you asking God for something, because throughout your day, you've already had God in your mind in every action that you've taken part in, because everything has to, in every connection, human connection you make, like that relationship should be directed towards serving God in some way.
Right. You know? And I could see what he means by asking for something, because one, when we do approach God, we have to ask that he would forgive us of our sins.
Okay.
You know, yeah. So I could see where he's going with that. It's just, saying it in a general, I don't know.
As a definition is.
Yeah.
It's pretty dry. It seems a little exclusive
right.
for your taste.
Right.
You
yeah. Say. Yeah.
Sure. I can see that. I actually kind of thought you might respond in that way when okay. I was listening to that. That's cool.
Well, you know me too well.
Do I? Do I? You can edit out whatever you want.
I told you he was weird. All right. So.
Well, do you know anything about meditation? More secular meditation, like the sort of meditation that came from Buddhism and Hinduism?
No. No.
Well, it's something I've been thinking about a little bit in preparation for the podcast is the difference between prayer and meditation. And after thinking about prayer and listening to the rabbi's definition, it seems like they're almost at opposite ends of the spectrum. Yeah. Whereas there are some similarities between meditation and prayer, obviously. So both of them take discipline.
Yes.
Right? That's the main virtue-based similarity, I would say. But whereas if we take the rabbi's definition somewhat seriously, even if we broaden it out to a more Christian one, that prayer is asking for something. Prayer is going outside of your mind, going outside of your being to connect with God, to ask for something, whatever it is for. Meditation, on the other hand, is completely internal. It's a very introspective process. You're sitting there, you're cutting out all conscious thought, and you're letting your unconscious thoughts pass in front of you. Okay. And you're observing them sort of from a third party perspective, if that makes sense. It's a very ego killing activity. You have to leave your ego out of it. Whereas in prayer, if you're asking for something, sometimes the ego can get in the way, you know? So that's where the discipline comes in. Are you deserving of the thing that you're asking for? And should you be asking God for it at all? That's where the ego can interfere, if that makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense. That's a very good point.
Right.
But Christians do meditate in a sense of whenever we read scripture, which is another discipline, we meditate on the words that we read.
Right.
And, you know, to better understand them.
That is meditation.
Yeah. Yeah. For example, in church, sometimes, other than the fact I get told to shut up a lot, I don't sing. You know, I don't sing half the time.
Not when you're giving a sermon.
Well, no, that's different. I'm talking about singing. Like, not even gonna try. I'm gonna lose listeners. But no, I'll stand there and I'll listen to the lyrics of the song and meditate on those songs to get a better understanding of them.
Right. If you're reading scripture.
As if I'm reading scripture. Sure, now, sure. I'm an oddball because I like words. So I like to know the meaning of words versus just saying a word.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Sure, sure. Of course.
So
you should.
Yeah.
That's critical thinking 101. That's what I do.
Right.
So I try to do.
So I'll listen to a Christian song and, you know, I'm very critical of Christian music because, you know, it's theology in a sense.
Right.
And if I hear something that's not right and I've meditated and thought about it, I'm going to say that's not a good song. You know, and a lot of people will say, oh, well, Christians meditate all the time when they pray. Well, you got to be careful with that because prayer and meditation are different.
Right.
And, you know, prayer is your connection to God. And like you said earlier, meditation is basically you checking yourself.
Sure, sure.
You know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, because one of the fundamental tenets of Buddhism is that you're trying to reach a point of self-actualization, as psychologists would call it.
Okay.
And that can be with or without an external spiritual being.
Okay.
You know, but I think the confusion there between, you know, people who grow up Christian and then convert to Buddhism is their thinking is very individualistic. They think, well, I can reach self-actualization without a God, without fully understanding that God is part of you as much as it is an external entity.
Yeah. Interesting. Would you like to?
You like that?
I do. You want to go into that more?
Sure.
Especially the part when you say that God's part of you, because a lot of people and atheists do it or think it, that there's no need for God. There's no need for a spiritual being
right.
to control them.
Right. And they place themselves in the driver's seat as
right.
humans. They think humans can fill the God role just fine through science and rationality and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and because we're very egotistical people.
Right. We are. No, it is pure ego. I think atheism is pure ego. I mean, you know that I don't go to church anymore, and I haven't practiced religion actively in a long time, but I do not consider myself atheist. It's not because I went the other way, you know?
Right.
And, you know, we don't have to talk about my personal reasons for that. That might get too one-sided in conversation, but in general, I think people convert, you could say, to atheism out of reaction, you know,
yeah.
not well thought out reaction. It might be well thought out from a rational standpoint, but it's always going to be predicated on some assumption about God or about religion or about spirituality that's wrong.
Right.
It's a shallow, I think it's a shallow reaction to what religion and prayer and God is supposed to be about.
I'm going to step out on a limb and go this route.
Okay.
So atheists, let's say the ones that were Christian and then convert to atheism.
Right.
Let's say a loved one dies that they adored, loved. They pray to God that God would save this person's life. Now, you and I both know that cancer is at least 80% of the time uncurable.
Sure.
If not more.
Well, because it's so often caught and realized after it's too late.
Right.
Most cancer is discovered accidentally.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
Which is a scary thought. I mean, it makes you think that maybe before you're 30, you should get a CAT scan or an MRI just to make sure that there's nothing brewing in there. You know, I think about that all the time.
Yeah. You know? So a lot of people that leave the Christian faith and go to mm-hmm. the atheist side, when that loved one dies, they now want to blame God.
Right.
Instead of stopping and thinking, okay, first of all, yes, God is in ultimate control over everything, and he knows what's going to happen when it's going to happen.
Sure.
But we forget, when it's our time, it's our time. We also
right.
forget that, excuse me, God does allow certain things to happen to test our faith and do other things that I'm not going to get into on
sure.
this podcast. But an atheist will just reject everything about God
right.
just because they want no one controlling or telling them how to live.
Right. Anything remotely connected with religious thinking or religious principles, they'll reject out of principle alone without really thinking about the deeper meaning underlying it, you know? And, excuse me, I find that often, as a matter of principle, they tend to take a similar ego-based reaction as, say, a very individualistic person who converts to Buddhism from Christianity, and that they feel like because Buddhism is a spiritual journey that you can do on your own.
Right.
More or less that, you know, atheists kind of feel the same way. I don't need to be part of a religious community in order to be the best person that I can be. I can have a moral foundation, and act well in the world without, religious practice, you know? And I do think that that's true to a certain extent, but that's not necessarily a reason to disregard religion on the whole. Simply because it may be true for you that you can live well without organized religion, you're still going to appeal on some level to an entity outside of yourself as a god figure, an ideal, whether that's a Christian god or self-actualization, which is an ideal that you're trying to aim toward in Buddhism, which is a sort of god, you could consider it, or rationality and the scientific method. People believe in that just as religiously as they believe in any dogmatic religious faith, you know. And so I think it's the result of that misunderstanding is the result of a lack of introspection, a lack of understanding of one's own soul, but also a lack of understanding of the broader religious context as well. You know?
So when you say first of all, Buddhism or being Buddhist is not a religion. It's actually a way of life.
Sure.
Okay. But the one thing I noticed with, and I don't know any Buddhist people.
Right.
I remember what I was going to say. Scratch that. You said that an atheist person can live outside of a religious organized group and still be a good person.
Sure.
Okay. Let me ask you one question.
Okay.
I know you're not atheist.
Well, I'm saying that's what they say. I can't really speak from an atheist perspective. They can think that.
Okay.
I think it can largely be true, at least in appearance.
Okay.
I don't know if it can deeply be true on a more spiritual level.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Now, I'm a step back to the Jewish folks.
Okay.
When I'm trying to remember the time frame.
Everything comes back to the Jews eventually, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I don't even know what that joke meant.
But Judaism, whenever they were set up as an organized people,
okay.
When they did their taxes, if you will, I think every third year they paid a little bit more in their taxes, and that money went to help, or not money, but grain and stuff like that.
Sure.
That product went to actually helping the homeless and the sick, and so they took care of their own.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Now, if you, and this is just my opinion, this is nothing that I've, you know, that I'm saying is true. Okay. But if you was to approach an atheist person and ask him, hey, can you help with XYZ?
Okay.
They may say
through, yes. Through taxation or otherwise, you know.
Right. They may say yes. Now, let's say we approach them and say, look, we're trying to build this well in Africa. We're trying to get some fresh water there. Can you help us financially? Well, what group? They're going to ask, well, what group is this for? Oh, this is for the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. Well, absolutely not.
Right. Yeah. I think they're very likely to take that attitude. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's the unfortunate part when you say, or not you, but when people say they don't need a religion to function. Now, look, I'm not for, yes, I'm Christian, okay? We all know that. But we also need to not let our religious beliefs get in the way of how we...
Helping people.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, being humans, you're right? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the propensity for, say, an atheist to deny resources or deny any assistance to someone of a religious group is the product of group identity.
Favoritism.
Favoritism, we could call it, sure. And it, you know, that sort of thinking is very deeply entrenched in our human evolution. We are tribal to some large degree by nature. And so you join, it's almost as if they think, well, they play for the other team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to, like, because I'm a Saints fan, I don't want to donate money to anything associated with the Atlanta Falcons, right? It's a very tribal, team identity-based dilemma that they find themselves in. And I think that people who take the extreme reaction, you know, growing up Christian, Catholic, whatever the case is, I know plenty of these people personally who go hardcore atheist as a reaction. They're kind of jumping from one team to another based on a few things that make them feel not so good.
Right.
You know, it's a very feelings based, very non-rational thing at its core, I think, because they're still playing the group identity game. They're still playing the tribal game.
It's their safe zone.
Right.
Safe space.
Exactly. It is a safe space. So if you really take time to think about think for yourself about what you think is true, apart, you know, separated from all of that team business, then you find yourself being either somewhere in the middle, like maybe I am, or from your perspective, being a religious person and a good practicing Christian, a good person who doesn't, who isn't a good religious person, but not a religious nut. If like you're not a dogmatic fanatic, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And there are just as many atheistic dogmatic fanatics as there are religious ones. And so you can extract everything that's good from your religious faith and not impose your will on others to an extent that it's going to start one of those tribal
right
battles. Yeah, if that
like,
makes sense.
Like, okay, for example, you and I having this discussion right now. We're talking right about two different topics here, and let's say you were atheist, and because we're friends, I know this would go this way. You and I would have this discussion about, you know, religion and non-religious stuff, and we wouldn't fight.
Right.
But if we take this to somebody that doesn't know us, it's going to be a fight. So.
Sure, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Totally agree.
But you're the one who signed up for you know, this episode with me as a co-host, being more secular perspective, I guess.
Yes.
And you know what you're getting yourself into. If you willfully put yourself in a position, then, you know, it's the mature attitude to take in not letting it get too heated, you know, not I guess, and obviously we seem to be agreeing on more than we're disagreeing on
yeah
today, but
I don't
if you willfully put yourself in a position, then it is your responsibility to deal with it, if that makes sense.
I don't agree with that statement. No, I'm joking. All right. Let's see the next question. Do you think religion will ever become obsolete?
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. So I think that's a good segue from where we just came from. Because I think I could imagine a universe in which, like, that would sprout out of where we are now, that in which no organized denominations would be necessary. I think that you can have your cake and eat it too, to some degree. I think you can have a deep spiritual affinity and relationship with God, without having the closely knitted community aspect to it, without necessarily going to church every Sunday, without, you know, going through all of the formalities that Christianity or Judaism has held on to for centuries. I think that could be possible, but will it happen? I'm not so sure, especially if you include other religions as part of this potentiality. So I don't think that Islam is going away anytime okay soon.
Yeah.
You know, but those are for reasons that are not only based in human nature and the nature of religion in general, but because of how Islam is, because of how the people from that culture are, I think that their religion is going to not only persist but spread and grow
right
to a very large degree.
Okay, now you said that
so is it realistic? Do I think it'll happen? Probably not, but I can't imagine a society without organized okay religion.
And I get where you're going sense with that, but
it's hypothetical.
Now you said I should have wrote it down.
Uh-oh,
I'm getting old.
That's what editing's for.
No, but you said something about if we were to have a universe without an organized religion and not mm-hmm going to church to be able to, I guess, fellowship with like-minded people.
Yeah.
Here's why I'm going to disagree with you on that point.
Sure. Please do.
The organized denominations, I get that's because of different things that we're not going to get into. That's another episode in and of itself.
Yeah.
But corporately, if it's a Presbyterian, a Baptist, a non-denominational, a Catholic, whatever, corporately, we all agree that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, came to the world, died for our sins. Okay, we get that. But the reason we have church or gathering mm-hmm is so that we can corporately hear the word of God and we can corporately worship together as a believing body.
Okay. So I'm actually going to ask you to answer one of your other questions that you had.
Okay.
On that. So why does united prayer exert a stronger influence upon a soul, an individual soul, than when one prays alone? I'm assuming that you're going, well, this question, this is a loaded question. This question assumes
it's a 12 gauge.
Yeah, exactly. It's a loaded question, and it is a 12 gauge. It'll blow in a big way to someone who disagrees with this. And I'm not saying I disagree with it, but it does assume that united prayer does exert a stronger influence upon a soul than when one prays alone. Now, first question: do you believe that someone, assuming heaven exists, someone could make it to heaven, live a spiritually fulfilling life without an organized religious context?
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to give you a yes and no. Mainly a yes.
Okay.
But if a person is claiming to be Christian, claiming to follow the teachings of Christ, then it states in scripture that we should fellowship with one another. Okay. So how can one grow if he's not in that same body of believers that, I'm going to say, believe the same thing, because sometimes within that body you can have different beliefs and perspectives. But overall, if you have the same person that doesn't go to church, you know, but is connected with God, prays all the time, sure, asks God for forgiveness of their sins, you know, can they get to heaven? I'm going to say yes.
Right.
But one thing they lack in their journey,
it will be on some level not completely fulfilled, because it lacks a community aspect. Sorry to cut you off.
No. I would say, how can they grow further?
Okay, I see.
If they don't fellowship with those who believe like.
Right. And you believe that fellowshipping does take you a step further?
I do, absolutely.
Right. So I feel like that's a very good answer that is going to keep intact your potential profession as a minister. Very wise answer. So to segue into the next question, why does united prayer exert a stronger influence upon a soul? Why do you think that is? Because I'm not completely sold on that. I can see both sides maybe, but I do want to hear your answer, and maybe that'll spark an idea.
I'm not sold on it either. That's why I was asking you.
Fair enough. That's what discussions are for. Well, let's think about it for a minute though.
Well, let's take a look at the meaning of the words.
Sure. Fair enough. That should have been my point to raise, right?
You know, so let's see. Stronger prayer, influence upon a soul.
So what do we mean by united? Is that a bunch of people in a room praying together?
Mm-mm.
Or just being part of an established community and
yes,
maybe having the understanding that you're praying for the same thing at the same, roughly the same time? And, you know, if like one member of the church comes, you know, gets cancer.
You just answered the question.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone is going to participate.
Yes.
Both in church and, like, you know, during you know, the more meditative sections of the, I'm butchering it, of the service, but also in their personal life,
right?
You know, for the time that is an issue, people will be praying for it collectively,
right,
in a sense, even if they're not together.
Correct. Now let's backtrack,
sure,
slightly. When we say the church, remember that the church is not a building with four walls.
Sure.
Okay. The church is referred to as the bride.
Okay.
All right. Well, I could use that, but I'm not.
Well,
I'm not.
Okay.
Because
I would have asked you to elaborate.
I'm going to use the building aspect more. Mm-hmm. So the church is just not the building we go to every Sunday or Wednesday or whatever.
The building is symbolic for something more.
Correct.
Something greater.
Correct. But the church collectively, you could be in Africa working, but you attend First Presbyterian Church downtown Thibodaux and still praying for that person in the church that has cancer, or that person we met.
You're
that
still a member.
Right.
Still, right.
That person that doesn't believe in God, but came to church several times seeking answers,
right,
collectively inside the church and outside the church, or the four walls, I should say, we're praying. Now, if I meet somebody that doesn't attend my four walls, and I tell them about the situation, they too should join in with us and pray for that person. So that's what I was getting at when I wrote this question.
I see. Gotcha. Yeah. Interesting. Well, it It does seem like if there is any evidence and credibility to support the idea that prayer works at all, then it would be more powerful in numbers. That's a question unto itself. There have been some studies done in psychology, parapsychology in particular, that support the idea. There are small correlations, but correlations nonetheless, that do support the idea that prayer works, either from one person to another or from a group to another. The studies have not been done to a large degree because of some of the atheistic attitudes that run the scientific community, right? So prayer is disregarded. It's not even really, it's like astrology. It's not given a chance to be tested in most cases because most people in the scientific community are already atheist and already reject the idea on principle alone without really being willing to question it and test it, which is what scientists should do. They should test everything. That's their job. You know?
Permission to diverge a little bit.
Of course.
What does the word science mean?
I gave a little bit of that at the beginning. It's a method of inquiry. It's not a belief system, as some of these like more atheistic types would like to believe, even if they won't admit it. but their actions show otherwise, if that makes sense. Science is a method of inquiry designed to collect data and to test that data, to come up with hypotheses and predictions about future events in the material empirical reality that we live in order to learn more about the patterns of the material universe so that we can not only further our understanding about that for the sake of itself, but ultimately, I think, to help people and to help drive our human race forward in a positive manner. You know, I think that's a definition of science that maybe should be adopted by more scientists themselves and maybe should be understood by people who are anti-science as well. I think science should be meant to serve people and serve higher goods.
Yeah, because the word in and of itself is the study of knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, and vaguely. Right. You know, collecting data and studying it and coming up with hypothesis and everything. That's right. You're gathering knowledge and you...
Of course. You can't have real empirical knowledge without formulating hypotheses and then testing them and finding out what's most true about empirical reality. You know, my view is that empirical reality, the physical world, is only one realm in which we live.
Right.
It's just one aspect of especially human life.
Yeah.
You know?
And believe it or not, I actually like science.
Yeah.
You know,
you should. I mean, it's
yeah. I mean, God wouldn't have given it to us.
It's extremely useful. Yeah. Yes.
All right. No.
But it's very powerful though. Science is very powerful and it's very persuasive. And on a spiritual level, it can be very deep if it is serving the higher goods. But if it's not, then it can be dangerous.
Okay.
Like anything.
So looking at it from, I'm going to be the guy that's going to now play atheist.
Okay.
And I'm probably not going to be good at this, but I'm going to give it a shot. Well, science says XYZ 50 years ago.
Sure.
Okay. But new scientists came along, tested that hypothesis, and then it changes.
Yep.
Why doesn't Christianity change?
Are you asking me, expecting me to take the Christian perspective?
Yeah, we're going to flip. Well, you're not atheist.
That's okay. I can ask the atheistic questions too, though. So why hasn't religion changed? Religion has changed to some minor degree in its reformations, in its councils, in its identity within the cultural context. Religion does change to a degree, but the concept of God doesn't change. The concept of free will and what we're meant to do as good citizens, as good moral beings, that doesn't change or shouldn't change, I don't think. Culture can affect that because culture can force certain expectations upon people as far as what they should do, how they should be, how they should act, how they should interact with other people. And so that can alter the religious perspective to some degree. That can influence it in a not so good way, mostly, I think.
But there's no proof that God exists.
Well, what do you mean by God? And that might be a discussion for another
episode.
Because I tend to not like to personify the concept of God, but that's kind of my preference. And I think that's one of the things that drives me away from practicing spirituality within a religious context, is because I think that there's too much of an emphasis placed on personifying the concept of God. And I haven't really wrapped my mind around why that's absolutely necessary in almost every religious context. You know, even in Islam, of the Abrahamic religions, I think Islam has the least human form based idea of God, but it's still incomplete in my view. I think personifying it, making God a human figure, and clearly the Bible says that we were made in his likeness and image, but I don't think that means in form, in physical form. I think it means such in spiritual form. Like, we're all spiritual beings.
Right, mind, body, soul.
God is in us. We're in God. We're all part of one organism, which is the universe. I think all religions, to some degree, do agree with that. But if you know, personifying the idea of God is one way of taking a concept that's so grand, that's so beyond us, although we're part of it, because we can be beyond ourselves too, on a deep psychological level, you know? It's just to make the idea of God more simple so that we can fathom it, you know? We offer things up to God. To me, that means we show gratitude for having things that maybe we don't feel like we deserve, you know?
Good point.
Because often that's what gratitude is. It's something. It's a virtue that you practice when you have something that you didn't earn by merit alone. You can be proud of something. That's the difference between pride and gratitude. You're proud of something that you worked hard to get, and you achieved it, and so you can be proud of that accomplishment. But showing gratitude, it's like showing gratitude for life, for being alive. You have to do that, whether you're religious or not. You have to some degree, because you didn't earn it. You did nothing by your own will. It all starts from somewhere, right?
Whew. I'll say amen to that. All right. So what I want to do now is kind of go back into the question and answer format totally. We were doing. And this is your personal opinion, Britton. Okay. No pressure.
Are you asking my opinion now?
So after this episode, you're going to probably read that two people went to jail for fighting.
No.
Is humanity headed in the right or wrong direction from a philosophical standpoint?
From a philosophical standpoint? I mean, do you want me to kind of bring spiritual or religious thinking into this, or I don't know. It's hard. It's such a general and vague question, you know?
Well, no.
I just want to know, I guess, what you mean.
You have to load a shotgun every now and again too. Come
yeah,
on, man.
Yeah, totally.
So what I'm getting at is, all right, so we're talking about prayer.
Sure.
And we're taking a break from prayer, which it's still part of it. And we're just looking at the moral hierarchy of the world at this point.
I see.
Do you think we're heading in the right direction or wrong direction?
I think we're in a phase right now. We have it so good in the West. By the West, I mean Western civilization, U.S., Canada, Great Britain, most of Eastern Europe, Australia. We have it so good that we're getting bored to some degree. We're coming up with reasons to act like we are justifiably miserable. And so you're seeing some demoralization of society. You're seeing demoralization of culture to a large degree with all this discussion about rights and not responsibilities. You know, people in certain political groups arguing in favor of, you know, human rights, taking a virtuous, self-righteous stance on certain topics and social issues for the sake of human rights. Now, but it comes often at the expense of responsibility. So let's take... Exactly.
I'm going to say it. Black Lives Matter.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the movements that misses the point, I think. If you take one aspect of Black Lives, welfare, largely in this country, welfare has a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has a righteous purpose at its core, but it's misinterpreted and it's misused. And it's overvoted for, it's overemphasized as a system, and it's abused to a very large degree.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm going to point back to the Jewish culture.
Okay.
When they would give more every third year to take care of their own. So, yes.
Which is a form of welfare.
Exactly. Right. And I'm going off on another tangent. Bear with me.
Please do.
Welfare, food stamps, any government assist program, in my personal opinion, ought to be used to help.
Sure.
So, if I were president, I would probably not be liked and probably impeached the first day. Because the way I look at the welfare, and I grew up on it. I'm not even going to sit here and say I didn't. I grew up on welfare.
And did it help you?
It did help me.
Yes.
But behind that help was, most people would say, a strong Black woman saying, you don't want to live like this.
Right.
Okay. So what I get from welfare is, for example, if I'm on welfare, I'm going to be on that program for a year.
Right.
And in that year, I'm out working.
You're working.
Trying to save money, trying to get my finances together so when that year ends, I can, you know,
you can transition
properly and sufficiently support myself without any help.
Right. Well, the goal is to eventually be able to support yourself without help. And welfare is a way of getting you started. You know, giving you what you need for your basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you a bit of a foundation, but it's not sustainable in the long run if you want some of the finer things in life. If you want to be successful, you have to take responsibility.
Right.
And make it out. That's one thing I did really like about your grandmother, man. She really pushed you, and you took the message to heart. And I think you don't want to live like this is such a better message and such a better motivator than, say, how some Black parents give their kids the talk.
Mm-hmm.
You're Black, you're oppressed. Mm-hmm. You're never going to make it out of the hood if things with the government and at the higher levels don't change, and it's not your fault, but it's what you have to live with. And they basically shame their kids into believing that it's everyone else's fault. And regardless of how hard you work, you're still going to be seen as someone who doesn't deserve your success or anything of the sort. And I think that's just a poisonous way to raise a kid. Like, it's just a poisonous attitude to have when there is every chance in the world, if you take it upon yourself to get out of that situation, you can do it. You are 100% proof of that.
Yeah. And look, my sister, my older sister, Andrea, she's another example.
Sure.
Some of us take...
It's in the blood.
It is.
It kind of is. It might
be.
Yeah.
And my sister, with her two girls, does not teach them to live under government oppression, if you will.
Right.
You know, and...
It's great.
I guess her philosophical mindset comes from my grandmother.
Right.
You know, I don't have kids, you know, but the simple fact that I'm going to push myself by the grace of God to be better and not depend on,
right,
you know, exterior help. Now, look, don't get me wrong. Whenever you need help, you get help.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
But you don't sit there like a baby that stays on.
You don't depend on the help that you have not really earned for yourself.
Right.
You show gratitude for it, first of all.
Do they?
Well, you know, I don't know. You tell me. I didn't grow up there.
Well, yeah, I did. I'm joking. I did. But that's
you
just my
have, boy.
Yes, sir. That's my take on the welfare system and the food stamp system is, you know, the philosophy behind it.
It's a starter.
Well, the philosophy behind it was for good.
Right.
But then you got now a bunch of oppressed people, and I'm not just talking black people. There's blacks and whites and of all different ethnic groups that are part of this system.
You got a speech impediment, boy?
Yeah. So I lost my train of thought.
So you have lots of people who depend on welfare.
Yeah.
But the idea isn't to depend on it. It's
a stepping stone.
Right. It's just exactly.
You know, it's supposed to be a stepping stone. But I do find, and I'm going to say it, and I live in America, but I think the American government allows this.
Sure.
Instead of, okay, they're opposing certain things and changing certain things that can actually wait 4 or 5 years. And then they're not looking at the things that's actually hurting the economy.
Right.
You know, because these people sometimes aren't working. Yeah, they go back and spend the money they got from the government in the stores, but they're not producing enough to take care of the families the way they want to.
Right.
You know, and you're right. That's why you get these black parents. And look, I'm in law enforcement. I see it all the time. You know, they'll tell the kid, you're black, you know, you're this, you're that. No. I mean, yes, they're black, but they're not oppressed.
They're not. Well, right. I think very few people on the group scale are oppressed in America. Like, to the largest degree that that people who get really fired up about group identity politics and stuff and try to analyze everything at a surface group identity level, you know, the truth is simply power dynamics, like group versus group versus group, and whichever group is in power is the one that lacks virtue. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I just think that's a shallow way to look at reality. I mean, if you look at even mind the last 400 years since slavery ended in this country, look at the last 30 or 40 years, how much racism has just disappeared, you know? So look, to some degree, like we're designed as humans, like we were talking about earlier, to be tribal to some extent. So you're going to associate with groups that are similar to you in certain superficial ways, and that's fine. But for the most part, it's just a small, thin barrier that is broken at the tiniest and most subtle instance of you interacting with someone from another group.
Right.
So like I might be like 2% racist toward black people, but as soon as I meet another black person and have like even the slightest interaction with them, when they project to me that they're just another person like everyone else is, then that racism goes away completely.
So you're telling me that's how we became friends?
Exactly. I really do believe that. I mean, you know, people who say that like white people are racist and there's nothing they can do about it, and that having a black friend doesn't mean that you're not racist. I think that's complete bollocks. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are white men who are married to black women who are condemned as racists when
I know two. Interracial.
That's absurd. Yeah, like, what do you think you do?
Completely absurd.
What do you do every morning when you're having your coffee and you're sitting across the table from the person? Do you just like drink the coffee all angry and just like stare at them like, yeah, this'll show them that I'm not racist. This'll show them. Or do you actually love the person? Like, why'd you marry the person? Out of vindictiveness or because you love the person? I mean, right. Which is more likely? Let's put the question that way.
I know two interracial couples, and one of them I met in college. And when I tell you, I have never seen, and I'm gonna use racial terms here just to get my point across. I have never seen a white man love this black girl
like anyone has loved anyone ever.
Exactly.
Right.
And I'm talking, he takes care of his wife, and they are married till this day.
Yeah.
You know, there's no racial
tension at all. Tension's there. Yeah, of course.
And I want to correct
one person and another person. And
right.
They can form a holy union like anyone else.
I want to correct myself. I know three interracial couples, and the second group is also from college.
Right.
Same concept or same mindset. And yeah, they're all Christian, and they all believe in God, but these two white men take care of them black girls.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not because they're black. It's because they love them.
And they're religious?
They're Baptist, yeah.
Are they conservative?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I know one of the spouses is probably not.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that, like, I have not seen less racism anywhere. How am I going to put this? A church context in which there is ethnic diversity is the least racist place you can exist as a human being. And they tend to be conservative because most Christian denominations are pretty conservative, and their members take on certain conservative political beliefs because there's just a lot of overlap between an interpretation of the Christian faith that is founded in justice and the good, as I'll call it, and conservative ideals. You know, there's a lot of overlap there. So for the sake of consistency in belief, people who are religious tend to be conservative politically.
Yeah.
And it's just funny how conservatives are labeled nowadays as ruthless racists who will never get over that, when it's just not the case at all. You know,
let's be honest. Okay. So let's use me, since I can be the end of a joke.
Oh yeah.
So
you're a triple threat too.
I am a black guy.
Yeah.
I am conservative.
Yep.
Does that mean,
and you're religious? Yeah. You're a triple threat, man. That's,
you know, does that mean I wholeheartedly agree with everything that's going on in the country? Absolutely not. You know, but here or there.
And also,
whatever.
Does that mean that you're on such a tightly knit team within your church, within your position of blackness and maleness and conservativeness? Does that mean that you think exactly the same as all of those people who you share those jerseys with?
Britain, I don't see color.
I know.
You know,
that's my point.
You know, and for example, like, I'm this black guy, 30 years old, conservative, understand what's going on. I go to an all-white church.
Right. That's true.
Now, there have been
times... Well, now it's all white. It wasn't always that way.
It wasn't always that way. What are you saying?
Not when I went there.
Oh. but one of the things that I see is, okay, yeah, I've looked at... Let me try to find a church that is more diverse or more black people. It didn't happen.
It doesn't matter.
To me, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Now, I go to that church every Sunday I can that I'm not working, and those people, and I'm being racist again, those people do not show me any kind of hatred or racism whatsoever. No. They love me for who I am.
They love you for who you are and the competence you show as an elder and a member of the church. Because you are competent and knowledgeable, and you have a way of articulating your faith that is clear, and you do what church people do on a very high level, you know?
Yeah.
So that you've earned their respect as well, you know? And I think that's the point at the end of the day. Like, judging someone is perfectly fine if it's justified, right? And how should you judge people? I think based on the respect that they earn within a given realm of competence. So you're competent. You have merit. You've articulated yourself well. You've grown up in the church, and you've worked your way up the ladder to elder status. You know, youngest elder ever in the history of the church.
No, I'm not.
No, you're not.
No, and actually.
But anyway, doesn't disregard my point.
That, right.
Like, merit and competence are better ways of judging people than skin color. You know?
Yeah, and then when this is funny, at my grandmother's funeral, I was asked to be an elder, and to correct you, I didn't work myself up to the position,
sure.
If you will. It was something that was prayed upon and voted on by the church, XYZ. I got asked back in September-ish, October, somewhere in that time frame, if I wanted to be a deacon. And I was already a deacon. But the person that asked me got it wrong. And
what's a deacon in the Presbyterian church? I didn't know that they had deacons.
Yeah, deacon in the Presbyterian church basically are your caretakers.
Okay.
Or caregivers, I should say. And then the elders would be your administration.
Okay.
You know, just sure. to kind of dumb it down a little bit. At my grandmother's funeral, my pastor announced that I would be the first black elder in the First Press Church in Thibodaux ever.
Okay.
And the entire church, and you were at my grandmother's funeral, you heard the church. Right. Oh, wow. That is awesome.
Yeah. After they got kind of hung up on the race thing.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm just sitting there with my hand under my chin like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. Oh, cool.
You didn't even know that.
Yeah. I wasn't even thinking about it.
I mean, you probably could have assumed that had it crossed your mind, but it didn't even cross your mind.
Yeah, it didn't.
Why would, you really don't see color, man.
No.
That's beautiful.
I mean, it's... Yeah, in political realm, I see it, but
you are hashtag blessed.
Hashtag. But yeah, so now that we went off on this tantrum off of philosophy and prayer, I want to try to draw us back in.
Thank you.
But all the stuff we said is relevant to what we're talking about. And
sure.
If people don't use critical thinking skills,
yeah,
we are screwed.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to cause our morals to do what I like to call a nosedive.
Right.
You know.
I think the greatest philosophers in history who wrote on morality would agree with that. A lot of the best philosophers tend to actually have some religious or at least a deeply spiritual mm-hmm. background. Even Immanuel Kant, who...
Yes.
Immanuel Kant was a very dry philosopher, very systematic... articulator of morals, and in his Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals, a very thin, maybe 67-page book, which I studied on the graduate level for an entire semester, studying just this one small, thin book. And I saw so much overlap between his idea of the universal law,
mm-hmm.
It's also called the categorical imperative,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of God. There's so much overlap, it's unbelievable. The categorical imperative, I'm going to butcher it to try to summarize it, because it is very complicated. But in general, it is an ideal to strive toward, to aim your actions toward. Your actions have intention, and you should do good for the sake of itself. And if it's for any other reason, whether it's selfish or otherwise, then it is not a genuine moral action. It has no moral worth, as right. he says. And he mentions very clearly in this book that the universal law or the categorical imperative is nothing more than an ideal. And when I started to think about that's... Up until that point, that was kind of in the back of my mind, you know? Because I'm always trying to connect the dots, like, okay... Could he be, say, Christian and that be consistent with everything else he's saying right now? And once he said that, I was like, ah, right. This is a non-personified God that he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the universal law is. And so I brought that up in a seminar, and there were a couple people who like nodded their head. They were like, yeah, like that makes sense. Happens that they came from a Christian background. Everyone else was like pretty atheistic
yeah.
and just kind of rejected the idea. But I don't think that there's really any getting away from that. If you can understand that God isn't simply some guy in the sky with a beard, then you can understand this. But even a lot of very smart atheists, but atheists nonetheless, get hung up on the idea that God is something that exists in the empirical
mm-hmm.
realm of reality. He's a material entity. I don't believe that that's true. I think that that's what Christ is. Christ was the material manifestation of God. And he served a symbolic archetypal purpose.
Hmm.
And that's the purpose of sacrifice. And he showed the value of sacrifice through his crucifixion. But God, per se, is not a material thing. You know? And so I think Kant understood that, and because Kant believed that the categorical imperative, the God concept, whatever you want to call it, is an ideal to aim your actions toward. He, on some very human level, understood, though he didn't project it outward, but he understood that living up to that categorical imperative is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Living up to God's expectations is impossible. That's what free will is for. And if you accept that you're imperfect, you know, that you are born with original sin, so to speak, and that you have to constantly battle that, then you can live a life of struggle, but of virtue. And that's the best you can do, you know. I don't know where else I was going to go with that, but maybe you can play off of that. But even philosophers like Wittgenstein, who's probably my favorite philosopher, wrote very little on religious belief. It's like a third of this book that I'm showing you right now. It's maybe 20 pages.
Cool.
That's all he wrote strictly on religious belief, but it's so tied in with the rest of his thought. And there are little spiritual ideas speckled throughout his philosophy, but a lot of people think that because Ludwig Wittgenstein was like a hardcore logician, that he was an atheist, just like his teacher, Bertrand Russell. But I don't think that's true, because he deeply wanted to live and understand the moral life. And all the best philosophers were inclusive in that way. They thought more broadly mm-hmm. about reality than simply logic or simply science or simply the physical realm. There was a spiritual bent toward that, because that's where meaning is, you know. What does it mean? What does God mean? What does religion mean? Even if a philosopher is only spiritual on that level, they want to know on a philosophical level, what is God? What does it mean to live a moral life? They're likely to incorporate that into their life. And that's just their way of understanding it. That's their religion in some sense.
I'm going to briefly touch up on, I don't know if you ever heard of Jonathan Edwards.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Jonathan Edwards was a Puritan pastor, also a philosopher, or did philosophy and stuff like that.
Sure.
But he was completely sure of his faith.
Okay.
You know, he was probably one of those philosophers like, okay, this guy's Christian. How does philosophy, you know, even play into that?
Sure.
So my last question for the evening.
Okay.
Is, can philosophy and religion complement one another?
Absolutely. So given the overlap between philosophy and religion, being asking a lot of the bigger questions, philosophy asking the bigger questions about everything. There's a funny saying, a quotation by Dorian Sagan, Carl Sagan's son, about the difference between science and philosophy. He says the scientist learns more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. And the philosopher learns less and less about more and more until he knows nothing about everything. I think that's very accurate as far as what philosophy does, or the effect that it has on your understanding of the world after you've read a bit of philosophy. You know, you learn less and less about more and more until you know nothing about everything, until you gain a perspective that makes you realize that you can't really know everything about anything, that there are always going to be questions mm-hmm. that you can't answer, that there's always going to be something left over that you can learn from, and that you have to incorporate that lack of knowledge into your being. You have to allow that to drive you forward and to be more curious and to be more creative and to make your life better and to make yourself better and everyone around you better. And instead of letting it dishearten you, instead of letting it repress you and turn you bitter and resentful at the world, you know?
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of that in the scientific community, that negative attitude toward religion and philosophy. And, but I mean, think about like what I just said. If you approach philosophy in the right way, it makes your life better. That's what religion is meant to do. But on the basis of tradition and practice and community orientation and prayer and meditation and song and all of the formalities and things that you do in a religious context, you know? So an understanding of the philosophical perspective can complement your religious life if you're religious. Mm-hmm. And an understanding of some of those traditions and practices on the religious end can give a context to your philosophical knowledge. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, I want to thank you guys for listening in. This is probably my longest podcast ever.
Yay, that was my goal.
But, you know, Britton and I, we've been friends for close to 23 years. 23? Since we were five.
Since we were five or six, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, I was five, you were four.
That's right. Yeah, I was in little school when you came to the church, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then a couple years later, this kid that looked like Ralph off of the Christmas Story asked me to join Boy Scouts. So the purpose of this episode, you know, it's kind of a deviation away from your typical answer of questions about prayer. Sure. And I'm trying to get the listeners to basically open up with critical thinking and philosophy.
Sure.
So, but do you have any other closing statements you want to make?
Closing statements. Well, I do retract that my perspective is a secular one. I think we mentioned that once or twice in the beginning. I do feel a deep spiritual, I do have a spiritual inclination, a spiritual side. But as someone who is very interested in critical thinking and also very individualistic and rebellious personality-wise, I tend I tend away from organized religion, but I definitely, from my philosophical perspective, I don't look down on it in any way. I mean, it's something that's very useful for a lot of people and important, and I don't think that the atheists are right. I tend to side more with the Christian community than with the atheistic community. When it comes to these philosophical questions, mm-hmm. Because I find that atheists sort of miss the point about religion and spirituality in general. And a lot of them might say something like, "I'm a spiritual atheist." I'm like, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. You know,
again, what does the word atheist mean?
Right.
You know, I said,
well, it's a rejection of the existence of deity.
Yeah.
But they have not clearly defined what a deity is. They don't get it. Sorry. So, I'm not saying that religious people get it either to a full degree, not everyone anyway. But I tend to side a little more with the religious folk because at least if there is a lot of uncertainty in their faith, they're still sort of clinging on to some of these traditions and to their religious community, because in the back of their minds, they know that there's something good in it. And maybe there's some reason, something that they would lose if they were to get rid of it,
right?
You know? And so to take that sort of conservative approach to religion, I think is important. You don't come up with new ideas and change the whole system from the top down for the sake of it, because you see one or two little things that are wrong in religious ways of thinking from a logical or scientific standpoint. Mm-hmm. That's not really the point of religion. It's an action based thing. It's an action based activity. And, we should treat it with respect because it's a lot older than we are. So there's always something that we can learn
and
from
it's
it.
It lasted this long.
It has, you know, lasted a long time, and it's older than we are. There's always something to learn from it. There's always something in it that that we'd be missing without at least understanding it, you know?
Yeah, so hopefully I reached my goal here. I was trying to get some critical thinking wheels moving here, and
sure.
I think we can't coexist. Like, for example, an atheist will outright fight with a Christian Yeah. Even if they try to share their faith with them.
They won't change their mind.
Right.
You know, they're not going to change their mind on the basis of something the Christian person said. And vice versa. I mean, typically, even if they're both raising good points, it's one of those divisive issues where statistics actually show that the more evidence, the more good and true evidence is raised against your point, in fact, the more steadfast you become in your dogmatic belief, not less. So that's our tribal nature kicking in and kind of defending our safe space and defending our ego often. And I just think that, you know, at the end of the day, you have to let ego go for the sake of open discussion with other human beings, regardless of what they believe or what color their skin is. And for the sake of prayer, you know, and meditation alike, ego is a killer. That's where your unconscious motivations are hiding, and you're not always completely aware of how they're holding you back, you know. But I think there's a lot in religion and in philosophy and in science too, in all three of those areas, that can open you up.
Right, and I close with this, you know, as a in today's politics, which will get us in trouble if we even talk about it. We have to have critical thinking. We have to critically think about, you know, racism, abortion, non-religious, religious. We have
all
to
of
do
the
that.
Issues.
Yeah, because if we don't, then we're going to constantly find ourselves fighting with each other.
Yeah.
We're going to literally look like the United States Congress. But anyway. And critical thinking is being taught less and less in you know, secondary school.
Except for community colleges, as we're finding.
This is
like kind of my idea. I mean, I agree 100% with what you're saying. And this was one of my ideas behind wanting to teach philosophy and what I'm going to be starting to do either in the summer or in the fall, whenever my paperwork goes through. But I was very pleased to find that philosophy is creeping back into the curriculum in a lot of places, whereas like it was kind of struggling for a while, for a couple decades, and it's making a comeback. It's making a big comeback right now. And I think that's a really good thing. Cause a lot of people have found religion through philosophy, you know?
Yeah.
Some people need that very, strictly logical and philosophical point of view, of like philosophers of the past to convince them that spirituality is worthwhile, you know? And I have to relate that to my own experience as well, because, I mean, not to say that I ever identified as an atheist, but for a while I was like, well, I guess, you know, on an empirical level, I'm agnostic. You know, empirically speaking, we can't know whether or not a material God exists. But then I started to think, I was like, well, God isn't a material being. So the whole atheist, agnostic, theist discussion's stupid, you know? So just get away from it. It's not deep enough.
Yeah.
It's just not deep enough. So I tend to avoid it because it misses the point in principle. And so for a while, I was agnostic-ish until I just started to think a little more deeply about spirituality again, and it kind of came back to me, you know?
Yeah.
It has to find you, you know?
And then I'm gonna agree with what you just said, and I'm gonna add this.
Okay.
We all know your mama.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not all the listeners, but you should know my mama.
So, Miss Aline, I'm pretty sure prayed for you and continues to pray for you, and you know, probably will never stop until the day she dies.
This is juicy. She's never told me this. Please go on.
She hadn't told me either, but just knowing your mom and knowing her nature, I mean, I'm pretty sure this happens, and we'll ask her when we go downstairs. But but she prayed for you, and one of the things that a mother does, especially a Christian woman, a Christian mother, is they pray for their kids. And they pray that they...
Is that like part of the package deal? Like if you're a Christian and you have kids, you have to pray for them?
Well, really? Is that really a question? Of course you pray for them. So your mom prayed for you, and I'm going to correct you on, well, I can't, but I will. You said that most people found religion through philosophy.
No, I say that's one, I don't remember saying the word most of, most, but I meant that that's one way that a lot of people,
okay.
It's one route that some people have to take in order to understand the value in religion, if that makes sense.
Or is it God using that as a tool?
That would be God using that as a tool. Yeah.
All right.
That's one way to think about it.
Okay. So that's all we have, guys. I hope you enjoy this lengthy podcast, and definitely going to have more discussion with Mr. Britton.
If that's what the viewers want.
Yeah.
The listeners want.
Pretty sure I'll get the emails.
You're a professional podcaster now. You exist at the will of your audience.
Amen.
But God is in your audience. Therefore, you're at the will of God as well.
Or two or more gather.
Exactly. So it's community.
All right. So again, thanks, Britton.
You're welcome. This was fun. Thank you for having me. Yeah. Absolutely.
A long podcast. Yes, sir. Never thought I'd have one of those.
Yep. Joe Rogan style.
All right, man. Y'all have a great one. And thank y'all for tuning in. And stay tuned for more episodes coming your way on prayer.
You have reached the end of yet another episode from The Ear. We hope that God's word remains on the ears of the listeners. We pray that this podcast would urge you to go forth and spread His good news to the world. Thank you for tuning in. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. See you at the next episode. God bless you, and may His glory shine upon you.